This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Thank you, Mr. Xu, for those kind words, and thank you to the UOS and to Sanlam Cobalt for the opportunity to spend these few minutes with you, sharing some ideas and seeing some wonderful old friends, some wonderful young friends from old days. There's quite a synergy between Advocate Engelbrecht's presentation and mine, because he talks about what to do with the tangible assets that we can't take with us. And what rabbis tend to talk about is how to build up an intangible estate that you can take with you. I'm going to articulate very briefly perhaps the most serious challenge that faces business moving forward and the greatest opportunity since the invention of the internet. I'll give you some examples of companies that have grasped the change in thinking and have been doing so for quite a while already in the success that they've achieved, and then briefly illustrate to you how indigenous to Jewish culture and Torah thought this new paradigm of business thinking is. Our tangible products and services, their prices, their features, appeal to the minds of our customers and clients. Our brands, if we're fortunate, appeal to our customers' hearts and feelings. But the competitive challenge of tomorrow is not merely to access the minds and hearts of our customers, but to captivate their souls. On November the 6th, barely 2 weeks ago, the New York Times reported that for the first time in the history of Walmart, that mammoth company, known for its bullying tactics, is trembling in its boots. A new competitor has emerged that Walmart considers as one of the most serious challenges to its own dominance. The company it sees as its main competitor globally is a company I assure you each of you know. And probably each of you have used. That company's name is Google. Walmart considers Google to be its most serious competitor. Because you see, Walmart competes on price. And Google makes sure that customers anywhere in the world can find out in an instant where in the world you can get anything you want cheaper than Walmart. And Walmart has squeezed every ounce of every micro cent possible from its employees, from its suppliers, from its landlords where it has landlords. There's virtually nothing left to squeeze. But there's still some Chinese outfit or some Indian operation that can provide the goods cheaper. And Google will make sure you know that. If business outside of Asia insists on continuing to compete on price, Google will make sure we lose. Now, this is not all bad news, because what's happening is that virtually all commodities and services have been commoditized. Virtually every product, every service has been commoditized. There's hardly anything that any of us produce or serve that can't be produced or served cheaper by somewhere, by someone somewhere. However, it's only the tangible product that is able to be commoditized. To some degree, a brand can be replicated. But if a business learns how to captivate the soul of a customer or client, that dimension cannot be commoditized. Now, let's have a look at where and how that's worked. You see, we have saturated our customers with material choices. But their starvation for a spiritual satisfaction and sense of well-being is what represents the biggest business opportunity at the moment. We've developed superb structure and process to provide material security for people. But in a life where it's not our material security that is so much threatened, as the fact that our dignity is assaulted 1,000 times a day, material security is not sufficient. Our dignity is assaulted when we stand in a line. Our dignity is assaulted when we experience a rude customer or a demanding employee. Our dignity is assaulted when we experience road rage on the freeways. Count the number of times that our dignity is assaulted. And in times like this, our spirits crave a sense of meaning at the same time that our souls erode in the pursuit of the very consumerism that fuels business. And so while it is a challenge, the opportunity here is it's only the tangible product that can be commoditized. The intangible cannot be commoditized. The challenge is a little different. Firstly, it's not always easy to charge people for the intangible. Can't charge somebody for helping them out. Can't charge somebody according to halacha. You can't even charge somebody for a medical service. All you can do is charge the person for the time you lost that you could have been investing in your own business. But to actually charge for medicine, we're not permitted. To actually charge for Torah teaching, we're not permitted. We can charge again for the time we've taken to share our knowledge, which we could have been investing in our own business. But there's a certain ethical questioning about the right to charge for the purely intangible, the purely intellectual. And certainly you can't really leverage the intangible. But what we can do is we can overlay our tangible offering with a substantial intangible offering that is unique, that is valuable, and is that is irreplicable, and that satisfies not the material needs of people, but actually satisfies their spiritual craving. Is there a market for spiritual stuff? Well, walk into any bookstore. See what's being sold. Look at the therapy that's being purchased throughout the world. And look at the new age thinking and experiencing. Look at the travel destinations that people are going to and why. Look at some of the buzzwords in consulting. How the move towards the spiritual, towards the intangible. The craving is no longer for the tangible among developed nations. It's not our hunger for food and for housing. But there's an equally serious hunger for something much deeper. And if we can learn to satisfy some of that craving on the back of our tangible offerings, we have something that cannot be commoditized, that cannot be produced cheaper. A very simple example of that is the price differential between an economy class ticket purchased on the internet and a first class ticket to the same destination. That price differential is the value of the intangible. That gives you some idea of the ratio of value between the tangible and the intangible. The tangible is a seat in a safe aeroplane that gets you from point A to point B. The intangible is how you feel during the process. And that illustration will demonstrate that people will pay far more for the intangible component than for the tangible component. Let's look at an example of where that was done successfully decades ago already. Southwest Airlines is the most studied and quoted case study in the world. Every business school, every executive course, Southwest Airlines is the case study. What's interesting is that my analysis of Southwest Airlines differs a little bit, but quite meaningfully, from the analysis of the Harvard Business School professors and other business schools that have studied them. Southwest Airlines introduced no-frills travel at a time where that was unknown. So you've got to imagine it in that kind of environment. It wasn't something that was already established. Have you ever seen an Orthodox Jew in an aeroplane when they don't have a kosher meal for him or her? They get quite upset. You know what Southwest Airlines said? No meals for anybody. Why didn't everybody get upset and say that's just not acceptable? It's a standard in the industry that you get a meal when you fly. What happened to Southwest Airlines when they created this no-frills? No seats allocation. You know what happens if you get to your boarding and you're told, sorry, we don't have a reserved seat for you, but you know, get on and sit wherever you want, you'll find an empty seat somewhere. Well, I asked for a window seat, I asked for an aisle seat. Southwest Airlines came along and said, you know what, you want a window seat, get here 2 hours early and stand in line. And everybody said, okay. Why? Why did it work? Nobody could have predicted that it would have worked in the markets of that time. Between 1991 and 1993, to give you an example of their success in the early stages when this was such a challenge to do, United Airlines' share of the Californian market, which constituted 45% of United Airlines' revenue, so the California market, very important. Their market share of the Californian market reduced from 38% to 30% in those 2 years. Southwest Airlines increased from 26% of the market share of Californian air miles to 45% in the same time. So people abandoned United Airlines and gave up their meals and their boarding cards and their capacity to book their places through travel agents and all the other conveniences that Southwest Airlines took away from their passengers. People abandoned the conventional airlines and chose to travel Southwest. Southwest strategy, as explained by the business schools, is they only fly one aircraft, they fly the Boeing 737, their turnaround time averaged 15 minutes during a period that was studied, was on the ground for 15 minutes average. That was how quickly they were able to turn them around. Various different aspects that made them successful that enabled them to create a cost of 7.1 cents per mile as opposed to the industry standard of 10 cents per mile, which is a difference of nearly 30%. They had a figure of 81 employees per aircraft as opposed to the industry standard of 157 employees per aircraft. And they used one employee for 2,443 passengers as opposed to United Airlines using one employee for 795 passengers and American Airlines using one employee for 840 passengers. So the efficiency gains of Southwest Airlines were substantial. But what the business schools don't comment on is that perhaps the most important saving of Southwest Airlines was their fuel cost. Because removing food from the aircraft lightens the aircraft substantially. The trolleys you need to move up and down the corridors, the utensils you need, the refrigeration that you need, the heating that you need. All of that was a substantial fuel saving, which compensated for Southwest Airlines' disadvantage, and that was the main fuel cost is during takeoff. And therefore, the longer the flight, the cheaper the fuel. Southwest Airlines focused on short hops. So they had a fuel disadvantage, which was compensated for by the fact that they didn't have to carry food on the airlines. But what's really important, and I don't know whether Herb Keller, the CEO of that time, really understood what I'm saying now, or intuitively understood it, whether it was a thought-out strategy, but here's the fact. Look what they did. What was it that got people to fly Southwest Airlines? It wasn't just the cheaper flight, the cheaper price, because United met their prices. American Airlines started meeting their prices. They had to. And still, Southwest Airlines grew as the others dropped. And Southwest Airlines remained the only profitable airline consistently right through the difficult years. Even after 9/11, when everybody else was filing for Chapter 11, Southwest Airlines was making profits, huge profits. How do they do it? Yes, they took away the food. And they took away the fixed seating. And they took away all sorts of other benefits that passengers come to expect. But they gave the passengers something in place of that. They gave the passengers some fun. They made it fun. They made it light. They made it nice. That was before the days that it became kind of standard to have these canned jokes that some of the airlines dish out. They were original. They were spontaneous. They hired entertainers. When they employed their staff, they didn't hire them for skills. They hired characters that were potentially entertainers, people who wanted to be actors. That's who they hired. People with high social skills. They didn't worry about the other skills. You can train people to have skills. What was important to them was the personality of the people they hired, so that they could give their audiences entertainment. And you know, even in times of recession, people pay a lot for entertainment. Entertainment always sells. and they turned the travel experience into an entertaining experience. So they took away food and they gave it back fun. Now the cost in taking away the food, the cost saving was enormous. Not just the food itself and the staff you need to prepare and to serve the food, but the fuel saving. So there's a huge dollar figure related to the saving in taking away the food. What did they give back instead? Fun. How much does fun cost? It costs nothing to give. So they took a high cost, low value element out of the offering and replaced it with a low cost, high value offering. What Southwest Airlines understood was the equation, the formula that converts intangible into tangible. Don't think you only need tangible input to produce tangible output. The brilliance is in using intangible input for tangible output. And the reason that nobody could replicate Southwest Airlines, very simple. Southwest Airlines, realizing its competitive advantage was in the intangible, invested as studiously and persistently in the intangibles of that organization as they did in the tangibles. They were as vigilant about their culture and their value system as they were about the safety of their aircraft and the cost of their fuel and everything else that goes with it. I know of a case where a CEO of a large company was traveling on Southwest Airlines and was rude to one of the flight attendants. He not only was he a customer of Southwest Airlines, but so was his entire company. A week later, he got a letter from the CEO of Southwest Airlines, Herb Keller, and he was told, please to find another airline to fly on. He will not tolerate a passenger who displays discourtesy to his staff. And he would be quite comfortable with the CEO taking all the business from his company away to some other airline. Go and abuse someone else, he said. Leave our staff alone. Yes, he lost a big client. But what did he do to the sense of pride and loyalty and attachment of his staff? He achieved enormous intangible value, which could be reinvested into his organization to produce tangible outcome. Very briefly, Southwest Airlines is not a client of mine, unfortunately. But this concept of building intangible assets, investing them in an organization, and converting them to tangible, measurable output is what I've taken so much joy in helping people do. Just briefly, two examples. One was a very sophisticated hospital, healthcare organization in the United States. And that became a very competitive business. And what we helped them understand is that while they were probably the best in providing clinical care, that level was quickly being reached by their competitors, and they were beginning to lose business. But one thing they had the capacity to offer, because of their culture and tradition, that their competitors could not, was not just clinical care, but human caring. And we did some studies to demonstrate the measurable impact on the curing process of higher levels of human caring than just the lower levels and equally high medical care. But to achieve the higher levels of medical caring, the quality of culture that the nurses had to develop was something spectacular. But to develop and to deliver human caring costs nothing. The tangible benefits are enormous. One of the other interesting examples was Coca-Cola at the time that Pepsi-Cola was re-entering South Africa, and Coca-Cola was needing to consider severe downsizing at that particular time. Sanctions were coming down, Pepsi-Cola was coming in, and the customer base, Coca-Cola's customer base, was incredibly excited with the fact that Pepsi-Cola was coming in and that Coca-Cola would no longer have the monopoly. One of the many things we did with them was we helped them identify the intangible of their offering and their true customer. We help them identify that their true offering was not Coca-Cola. That's the tangible. That's the commodity. That's what Pepsi-Cola can replicate. And so can a whole lot of other people. The Coca-Cola brand, well, Pepsi-Cola with a bit of money can replicate the Coca-Cola brand or make their own. That's not what's going to stop the competition. What is the intangible offering? What's the spiritual offering that you're giving? We help them develop a sense of refreshment is what they're selling. Refreshment is a quality. Refreshment is not a thing. Refreshment is a way of feeling. Refreshment is something quasi-spiritual. And then we said, okay, who's your customer? We're talking now not about the Coca-Cola holding company, we're talking about the bottling companies. And they figured out their customer is not the person who drinks the Coca-Cola, their customer is the store that buys from the wholesaler, from the manufacturer. The little corner cafes, these are the customers. And I said, what you've got to look at is, to what extent are you refreshing them? If they're your customers, and what you're selling is refreshment, don't worry about the end consumer, that's their problem. Are you refreshing your customers? What's it like to deal with you guys? Didn't take very long to realize it wasn't a refreshing experience. And by converting it into a refreshing experience, the loyalty and connectedness between the retailer and the Coca-Cola bottler became so intense that Pepsi-Cola couldn't penetrate it. They took an intangible and converted it to tangible bottom line benefit. So while process produces commodity, product, it is culture that produces the intangible, irreplicable, spiritual overlay. You cannot design a process to provide the intangible. You can only provide the intangible with people. And that needs a culture, that needs a value system. That conversion formula, that intangible can deliver tangible, is what is so indigenous to Jewish thinking. I'll give you a few examples. Firstly, there are untold numbers of medrashim that talk about that quite clearly. There's one very famous one where the students come to their rabbi and they say, one of us, one of our colleagues, left the yeshiva and went into business, and he's doing so well, he's making millions. And we're living in poverty, so we're thinking of going into business too. He said, really, why do you want to go into business? To make some money. You don't have to go into business for that. Come with me. And he took them into a valley, and he appealed to God, and the mountain started coughing up millions of gold coins, and the valley started filling up with gold. And he said, if you want the gold, help yourself. But this is the outcome of your studying of Torah. This is your spiritual reward, converted into money. If you want to take it in cash, help yourself. If you want to keep it, and if you take it in cash, then you'll have to consult Rabbi Engelbrecht as to what to do with it when you die. Alternatively, you can leave it in spiritual currency, and you'll have it after life. Make your own choices. What is the Medrash teaching? Intangible and tangible is convertible. Money is an expression of value. You can create wealth with intangible input just as well as with tangible input. And many other medrashim, but even if we look in the area of halakha, what is an etrog worth the day after Sukkot? A rand? 2 rand? What was that same etrog worth a week earlier? $100? 1,000 rand sometimes? What's the difference? It's the same commodity. The difference is 995 rand worth of intangible value, of spiritual value, that people are willing to pay for. There's a market. What is matzah worth just before Pesach? What is it worth after Pesach? What is matzah? It's flour and water. Go and relate the cost of a piece of matzah to its content. And take all the costs that go into producing it. That's not what we're praying for. What is the cost of the strings of a pair of tzitzit? But a thread. What is its value? We understand that the tangible and the intangible unite to form unbelievable value. Value that we wouldn't sell for anything. Imagine, take not even a very practicing Jew, just take a traditional Jew on a Friday night, about to make Kiddush. There he stands with his glass of wine, 10 rands worth, I don't know what it is. about to make Kiddush. If I were to say to him, how much money do you want for that glass of wine? But that's the only glass of wine available. If you sell it to me, you can't make Kiddush. No Kiddush tonight. How much will you sell it for? Well, there's some people I'm sure will sell it for 15 rand, make a 50% profit. Not bad. But most people wouldn't. What do you mean not make Kiddush? They wouldn't sell it for 100, they wouldn't sell it for 1,000, some people wouldn't sell it for 10,000 rand. So what is the value of that glass of wine they're holding? Is it in the replicable commodity, or is it in the spiritual value that it contains? Every commodity, every product, has the potential of being overlaid with intangible value that is enormously valuable to a customer who craves the intangible. Service is just one of the very, very many areas where that applies. And that concept we saw even in this last week's parsha, where Avraham is saddened by having to expel Yishmael. And God says, don't worry, ki b'Yitzchak yikare shemecha, because your name, your brand, is going to be invested in Yitzchak. And the Medrash says, b'Yitzchak, there's a bet in front of Yitzchak's name, and the bet is two, there's a duality. It's in the duality that Yitzchak grasps that the Abrahamic brand will excel. And the duality is, mi shemodeh b'shnei olamot, one who recognizes the value of living simultaneously in two worlds. We don't just live in a tangible world. We don't just live in the measurable world. Nor are we individuals who dedicate ourselves purely to the spiritual. That's not our style either. The Abrahamic brand is the capability of living every moment of every day of an entire life, synthesizing two worlds. And the excitement of and the privilege and the work that I've been conducting is helping people manage that. Helping people manage in their businesses the synthesis of the tangible world with the intangible world. Understanding how, whereas process and structure produces product and commodity, it is culture and values that produce tangible output and true value. It's in understanding the two worlds and being able to walk that path of the two worlds, the material world of commodities and the intangible world of cultures and values, that enable an individual and organization to access and to dominate not only the minds and the hearts of their customers, but to captivate their souls too. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.